Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the longest-serving independent member of Congress, Senator Bernie Sanders, and discuss the all-nighter he and 28 senators are about to engage in all Monday night on the Senate floor, ending at 9 a.m. Tuesday, in an effort to raise awareness and confront the reality of climate change. Senator Sanders is the chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee and was recently interviewed by John Nichols at The Nation in an article, "Bernie Sanders, I am prepared to run for President of the United States." Then, with Russian propaganda ramping up to a fever pitch, inventing claims that the new Ukrainian government is oppressing Russian-speaking Ukrainians in the East, we will speak with the chair of Ukrainian Studies at the University of Toronto, Paul Magoshi, to find out whether Putin is laying the groundwork for an invasion of eastern Ukraine. The author of The Roots of Ukrainian Nationalism and the forthcoming Crimea and the Crimean Tatars, Paul Magoshi, researches nationalism, in particular among ethnic groups living in border areas, and he will describe the new government in Ukraine that Putin is demonizing. Then finally, we'll be joined by Princeton historian Julian Zelizer, the author of Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and discuss his latest article at CNN, Obama May Hate the Midterm Results. We'll discuss recent polls that indicate that the Republicans are likely to take back the Senate and hold the House in November's midterm elections, and what strategies Obama and the Democrats can employ this year to buck the historical trend that had Presidents Wilson, FDR, Eisenhower, Reagan, and George W. Bush all suffering reversals in their second terms, hastening their lame duck status. And joining us now is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history and is the chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee. Senator Sanders was recently interviewed by John Nichols at The Nation in an article, "Bernie Sanders, I am prepared to run for President of the United States." Welcome to Background Briefing, Senator Sanders.
Good to be with you.
And Senator, you and a group of 28 senators are about to pull an all-nighter Monday night in the United States Senate. You're going to be taking to the floor all night long talking about climate change. It does strike me as a little odd in the most powerful nation on earth, in many ways a leading nation on earth, that you have to strike a blow against anti-intellectualism and stand up for rationality, reason, logic, science, and truth.
Well, you're right. It is a very sad and distressing moment when, in fact, you have to fight for an issue that the overwhelming majority of scientists have long agreed upon. There is no longer in the scientific community a debate about whether climate change is real, about whether it is man-made, about whether it is already causing devastating harm to the United States and to the entire planet. It is extremely sad that we have virtually every member of the Republican Party not only refusing to act on this information, but even to accept what the scientific community is telling us. And it really speaks to a very dangerous anti-science mentality.
But apparently, lately, the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, has taken to the floor and talked about the pernicious influence of the Koch brothers in American politics. They're targeting a lot of Democrats in this November election. And a part of their agenda, not only do they fund climate change denial, but they want to replace these senators with senators who will go along with their polluting strategy.
Well, it's more than climate change for the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers and other members of the billionaire class, and these guys, the Koch brothers themselves, are worth some $80 billion. They're the second wealthiest family in America. And just in the last year, their wealth increased in 1 year by $12 billion. And what these guys are doing is not only pouring an unbelievable sum of money into elections and into political consultants and into the whole political process, they are funding many, many organizations out there to try to shape public consciousness in an extreme right-wing way. And Ian, we should be very, very clear, and it's not just climate change, what these guys believe in. These guys want to do away with Social Security. They want to do away with Medicare. They want to do away with Medicaid. They do not even believe in the concept of the minimum wage, so that if they had their way, people in this country could be working for $3 or $4 an hour. They want to get rid of agencies of government like the environmental protection agencies, which are trying to keep our air, water, and land clean. They want large corporations and the wealthy to be paying even less in taxes than they are right now. So these guys are funding a massive effort on the part of the wealthy and the powerful to cut virtually every program that the middle class and working families need and to enrich the wealthiest people in this country who are already doing phenomenally well.
Well, in your interview with John Nichols in The Nation, you talked about America being ready for a political revolution. It seems that striking a blow tonight, as the senators are, for reason and rationality and science, you are taking a stand, and I'm wondering whether this is going to be a sustaining movement here in terms of this election year.
Well, you know, as I define, you know, a political revolution, what that means is not just what happens here in Washington, D.C., what it happens is all over the United States of America at the grassroots level. Ian, what's going on in America today, as I think most listeners know, is the middle class of this country is disappearing. Despite huge increases in productivity and technology, we now have more people living in poverty than any time in American history. Real unemployment is not 6.7%. It is close to 13%. Youth unemployment close to 20%. And in the midst of all of that, while the average person is struggling in an almost unprecedented way in modern history, the people on top are doing incredibly well. And what that means is that in terms of distribution of wealth, you have the top 1% owning 38% of the wealth and the bottom 60% owning all of 2.3% of the wealth. And in terms of income, about 95% of all new income in recent years is going to the top 1%. What a political revolution means is that the tens and tens of millions of people who are working longer hours for lower wages, who are finding it impossible to send their kids to college or get decent child care for their children, that those folks begin to stand together to make it clear that we need an economy that works for all of our people and not just the 1%, and that we need a political system which is not dominated by the Koch brothers and other billionaires.
Again, I'm speaking with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He's the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history and the chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee. Senator Sanders was recently interviewed by John Nichols at The Nation in an article, "Bernie Sanders, I am prepared to run for president of the United States." Well, our history indicates, Senator Sanders, that we go through these ebbs and flows between progressive eras and reactionary eras, where the original Gilded Age was followed by the progressive era, and then the Roaring Twenties, and then another plutocratic age, and then the economy crashed, and then you had a progressive era under FDR, and then through, I guess, from 47 to 77, we had pretty much a social democracy in the United States. And then with Reagan, they managed to roll back middle class and working American gains to this new plutocratic age we're in now. But these ebbs and flows, to my mind, don't happen by some sort of almost divine motion. I think, don't these times require leadership? It doesn't just happen automatically that people wake up one day and say, I'm sick of the status quo and I want a revolutionary change.
Well, leadership is terribly important. And I think one of the crises that we face now is the average American is hurting economically, is disgusted with what's going on politically. The average family is a lot of pain, and I think they're not understanding. No one is explaining to them why what's happening. Why is it happening? I mean, a simple question: how does it happen that when we see a huge increase in productivity, the middle class declines, and people are working longer hours for lower wages? Common sense would suggest an increase in productivity would mean increased wealth for all Americans. That's not happening. And I think what has not been made clear to the American people is the nature of class warfare in America. And I use those words, Ian, advisedly. What has been going on now for a number of years is that the people on top, people like the Koch brothers, who are worth billions, apparently believe that having, in their case, $80 billion is just not enough. And they need more. And in order to get more, they're willing to continue their attacks against low-income kids, against people who are hungry, against unemployed workers, against workers who are making minimum wage. And that's called class warfare. And our job is to educate the American people and to organize, because at the end of the day, very few people believe in the Koch brothers' ideology that we give more tax breaks to billionaires and you cut Social Security, cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, do away with the concept of the minimum wage, make college more expensive for working families. Very few people believe that. And our job is to bring together the vast majority of the people who are hurting economically, bring together, as we talked about earlier, people who are terribly concerned about the implications of climate change, bring together those people who understand that the United States today is the only country in the industrialized world not to guarantee health care to all people, to understand that we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country. Our job is to reach out, bring people together around a progressive economic agenda and say to the Koch brothers and the other billionaires, you know what, you are not going to continue to run this country for your own benefits. We're going to have a government that works for everybody.
And Senator Sanders, in terms of the Nation article, I am prepared to run for president of the United States. There's obviously a big difference being prepared to run and making preparations to run.
Right. And all that I said, and what I mean by that, is that I think it is terribly important, Ian, that we have a serious discussion about the very, very serious problems facing our country. And if people are not prepared to run for office to represent the working class of this country, to represent the middle class of this country, to fight for a progressive agenda, I'm there and I'm ready to do that. I don't wake up every day saying, you know, I have to be president of the United States. It is an impossible job. A campaign would require raising just unbelievable sums of money, which, you know, in my case would not be all that easy. But what I am saying is somebody has got to raise these issues. The great middle class cannot of this country cannot be allowed to disappear. We cannot continue to have so many of our kids living in poverty without an opportunity. And we cannot continue to allow this country to move to an oligarchic form of society where so few have so much and so many have so little. And these people on top, they're not just content with their wealth. They are now, to an unprecedented level, exercising political power. What the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and these other guys are prepared to do is spend hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, to elect the president of the United States, to elect senators, to elect governors. And that is not the American democracy that most of us grew up believing in. That's called oligarchy, and that has got to change.
But if you were, for example, on the debates in the primaries, as we've seen before, to some extent, Dennis Kucinich played the role of pushing the Democratic debate to the left towards the sort of more towards the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, as is often said. Your presence in a debate with other candidates would have that effect. How are you going to, you're an independent, how could you get into that debate? Because that's where I think you could really make a difference.
Well, that's an excellent question that I haven't resolved in my own mind yet. One thing, and it will require a whole lot of discussion with people all over this country, and what you're really raising is the question of whether one runs as an independent outside of the two-party system or runs within the Democratic Party. And that's just going to have to be a discussion that we'll be having with a lot of folks. But at the end of the day, what is most important to me is, number one, that important issues which now are not being discussed are placed at the forefront of political discourse. Is the United States going to have a middle class or is it not? Are we going to tolerate this growing gap between the very, very rich and everybody else? Are we going to tolerate 22% of our kids, a situation where 22% of our kids are living in poverty? Are we going to be the only country in the industrialized world without health care for all, et cetera, et cetera? And the second point that I would make in terms of your question is I will not play the role of helping to elect some right-wing Republican as president. That I will not do. So, you know, there's a lot to be discussed. It's still quite early in the process. We've got a congressional election coming up in 2014 that I hope to be active in, expect to be active in. But, you know, that you've raised an important question.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Senator Sanders. I do hope that we can see you in this debate. And I understand the system is rigged against third parties, so it's a complicated path ahead. But I hope, I hope we see you in those debates.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who was elected to the United States Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history and is the chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee. Senator Sanders was recently interviewed by John Nichols at The Nation in an article, "Bernie Sanders, I am prepared to run for President of the United States." We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back discussing whether Russian propaganda is laying the groundwork for an invasion of eastern Ukraine. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Magocci, who is the chair of Ukrainian Studies and professor of history and political science at the University of Toronto. He has published 30 books, including A History of Ukraine, The Land and Its People, The Roots of Ukrainian Nationalism, and Ukraine, an Illustrated History. His research interest focuses on nationalism, in particular among ethnic groups living in border areas, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, Crimea and the Crimean Tatars. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Magocci.
Thank you.
And quite a lot to talk about here today. And I must say the tone that's coming out of Moscow now from the foreign ministry is quite alarming. The foreign ministries have suggested that Ukraine's new pro-Western government in Kiev are not protecting pro-Russian citizens in eastern Ukraine and that they're sowing chaos. And, of course, this is something of a repeat or an echo of justifications that Russia made to intervene in Crimea with the pretext that they had to protect Crimeans from abuse, etc. Just to quote the foreign ministry statement, Russia is outraged by the chaos which is currently ruling in eastern regions of Ukraine as a result of the actions of militants of the so-called right sector amid utter connivance of the new authorities, as they call themselves. So do you think that Putin and Russian propaganda are preparing the Russian people for another military invasion, this time of eastern Ukraine?
The simple answer to that question is yes.
So if that happens, how could you control that? So far, nobody's been killed in Crimea. There have been a few shots fired. But my understanding is if Putin were to do that, then you would have an all-out war.
It is quite possible that should Russia decide to make that move based on whatever flimsy justification they use, that's a different question. But if they would take that move of invading, assuming that they are coming to assuage the suffering Russian-speaking population of eastern Ukraine, yes, I can imagine very well that Ukrainians would respond militarily, both in terms of the organized armed forces of the state and even more likely the kind of unorganized partisan elements within society. This would be considered a complete violation of not only their sovereignty, but their nationality and their nation state.
So how much are the Russians playing games here rhetorically, or are they? I mean, do you think that Putin actually believes all this stuff, the kind of stuff that he said in his first press conference, where he described Kiev as being a bunch of right-wing fanatics in Kiev wearing armbands and swastika-like symbols, like a jack-in-the-box, some nationalist type of or semi-fascist element, some kind of anti-Semite could pop out? What's he talking about there? Because the current prime minister in this new government in Kiev is Jewish, and apparently he's had very cordial relations with Putin up until now.
Well, I think there are two things that need to be said in terms of the question that you've raised. The first thing is the most important, I would suggest, and that is what Putin is doing is not at all a surprise. It is in complete keeping with long-term historical Russian policy, and there's no reason why any of us should somehow be surprised that this is something new that he's doing. And what do I have in mind? What I have in mind is the following, that at least since the 14th century, there has been ideological preparation, first during the Muscovite state, and then its successor, the Russian Empire, then the Soviet Union, and now the Russian Federation, all of whom claim direct lineage one from the other. And the position going back to the 14th century and continuing up to the present with Putin is that all of the East Slavic peoples, what we understand today as ethnic Russians, Belarusians, and ethnic Ukrainians, are one Orthodox Rus people, culture, and civilization. That the most natural thing in the world is for them to live preferably under one political system, or, if not ideally, in a political sphere in which they are closely interrelated. This has been Muscovite, Imperial Russian, and Soviet policy, and now the policy of Putin for 6, 7 centuries. In that context, when during the 19th century, some of these peoples, in particular the Belarusians, but more so Ukrainians, began to argue that, wait a minute, we are not ethnic Russians. We are a different people with a different language and a different culture, and we have a right to our own self-rule. The Russian response immediately and continuing to the present, with the exception, a little bit I might add, of the Soviet period, is that there's no such thing as a Ukrainian people or a Belarusian people or a Ukrainian language or a Belarusian. These are just dialects of Russian. We are the same people. We come from the same Orthodox world. And therefore, to have an independent state, what for? This, from the standpoint of Vladimir Putin, is something in total violation of the Russian historical tradition. So that is one aspect, that is the cultural aspect, deeply embedded and ingrained in what we could say are the Russian cultural genes. They simply cannot abide by the fact that Ukraine exists in any form as a something separate from Russia. The second thing is, of course, the geographic and political strategic location of Ukraine. That is, it is its territory faces the Black Sea, warm waters all year long, something that Russia doesn't have and has always wanted. And this has been part of Russian Muscovite and then Russian foreign policy going back at least to Peter the First, as in Russian terms called Peter the Great. That is, access to the Black Sea, to warm water ports, and hence to the Mediterranean. The primary geopolitical goal of Muscovy and then the Russian Empire and then the Soviet Union to hold on to it. And in this context, it makes Crimea and other ports like Odessa in southern Ukraine now of exceeding strategic importance, combined with what I said before of the deep-seated cultural attitude of Russians toward Ukraine. So it's in this context that everything that we see now and is going on in the last week, and any statements by Putin, this is all detail. This is all simply an excuse, or looking for an excuse to achieve these overall century-long goals.
Well, but this may be what Putin feels and what Russian leaders have practiced over the centuries. But the latest polls in Russia indicate that the Russian people feel strong fraternal and cultural ties and familial ties with Ukraine and are not happy about the possibility of any armed conflict.
Well, you've just actually confirmed in another way what I've just said. What I was describing about Putin was not just simply him. He is reflective of deep-seated attitudes within the Russian people as a whole, within Russian culture as a whole. And absolutely, in this context, the vast majority of people in Russia support this position that is now being carried out by Putin. Absolutely.
Well, is that to say they would support an armed invasion of Ukraine?
Absolutely.
And what if it turns out the way that it surely will, into a hideous fratricidal battle?
If that were to occur, it would be terrible, but the fault would be on those people in Ukraine in power right now from, as they describe, extreme Ukrainian nationalists, anti-Semites, pseudo-fascists, illegal government, and so forth and so on, which with all of the phrases that are used to denigrate your enemy because you do not agree with your enemy, whether on geographic and strategic grounds or on cultural grounds.
Again, let me remind the audience, if I may, that I'm speaking with Paul Magochi, who is the chair of Ukrainian studies and a professor of history and political science at the University of Toronto. He's published 30 books, including A History of Ukraine, The Land and Its People, The Roots of Ukrainian Nationalism, and Ukraine, an Illustrated History. His research interests focus on nationalism, in particular among ethnic groups living in border areas, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, Crimea and the Crimean Tatars. Now, when you go back over the centuries, as you've done, my sense is, though, that it's the more recent history that in many ways reminds me of the Balkans, where where history becomes buried. It's sort of put into a deep freeze under the guise of Soviet fraternalism, and that the memories in Ukraine of Stalin's forced collectivization that killed up to 8 million Ukrainians between 1932 and 1933 are probably more fresher in the consciousness, or in the subconscious, if you will. And also on the Russian side, of course, they remember the ultra-nationalist leader Stepan Bandera and the extent to which Ukrainians collaborated with Hitler in killing Poles and Jews. So is that not a more recent part of the problem?
Present-day Ukrainians, of course, what I was speaking about until now was the thought processes of Putin.
Sure.
And how he reflects Russian culture and Russian attitudes toward the problem. I wasn't speaking about at all until now the Ukrainian perception of the problem. Without question, the Ukrainian perception of the problem is diametrically opposed, beginning with the fact that most Ukrainians, and I also hasten to add that there are many Ukrainians who are Russian speakers. Just being a Russian speaker does not make you a non-Ukrainian or does not make you a Russian. Ukrainians can be, ethnic Ukrainians can be Ukrainian speakers or they can be Russian speakers. And yet both of them can feel themselves equally to be part of the Ukrainian nationality and the Ukrainian nation state. From the standpoint of ethnic Ukrainians and all those who consider themselves part of the Ukrainian nation state, they obviously have a tradition in which, at least going back to the 19th century, that they have a right to their own culture, their own language, etc., and that they have been treated badly, to say the least, both by the Russian Empire and most particularly by the Soviet Union, which, as you've correctly alluded to, in the 1930s, this incredibly dastardly act of death by famine, Holodomor, it's known in Ukrainian, which was, to many people's specialists' views, an artificial famine. And even if one doesn't want to think that it's genocide, clearly 4 to 8 million people died in Ukraine. Not all ethnic Ukrainians, but the vast majority of them were ethnic Ukrainians. And this is deeply embedded as part of the Soviet heritage, which is now trying to be revivified by the present leadership in Moscow, under specifically under Putin. And it's therefore not surprising that they are totally opposed to this.
So what then can be done, just to get back to the urgency of the day, because we've agreed that some of the rhetoric coming out of Moscow is quite ominous, and it is reminiscent of laying the groundwork for what happened in Crimea, and in the situation in Crimea is anything but stable. The Tatars are not happy about it, and the Ukrainian minority are getting beaten up by Russian thugs for trying to protest this referendum that Putin is forcing down their throats as quickly as he can. So there's a real, I think, a real danger here that things could spin out of control. What can the Ukrainians do to satisfy this or to neutralize Russian propaganda about the notion that these people that have taken over in Kiev are a bunch of Nazis? I mean, you do have people in the government, the Deputy Secretary of National Security, Yarosh is a leader of the right sector. John McCain, when he visited the Maidan, he shared the stage with Svoboda's anti-Semitic leader, Oleg Tyrniabok, if that's the correct pronunciation.
Tyrniabok.
Yeah. So tell me, what can be done to dispel these ideas that have, you know, become Russian propaganda, and they've been picked up to some extent by the European left and by the American left?
Well, first of all, again, I'll return that because you've asked what Ukrainians can do to dispel the second part of your question.
Well, that's assuming that I'm correct in believing that this is exaggerated.
Of course, but you still have two questions here. You have the questions are, is what can Ukrainians do with regard to this threat from Russia on the one hand, that first is clear in Crimea and then will be clear, and then seems to be now clear in eastern Ukraine. That's one question. And then the other question is what can the present Ukrainian government do to dispel these attacks or claims by Russia that they are somehow a fascist or anti-Semitic or so forth and so on. So these are two separate questions. The first question is what can Ukrainians do with regard to Russian military threat, et cetera? I've said already, the only thing they can do is stand up and fight if that is going to lead that, because Vladimir Putin is not giving up Crimea. He has taken this territory illegally from Ukraine. He is not giving it up. And if anyone thinks that that's going to happen, they have no understanding of this long-term historical view of Russia toward this part of the world. Similarly, not only is he not ever going to give up Crimea, but he will most preferably want all of Ukraine, and certainly not to divide Ukraine. Why? Because all of Ukraine is part of this larger world of Rus, of historic, holy, Orthodox Russia, which he represents. So in this particular equation, what can Ukrainians do? I mean, they can't actually do anything other than stand up for what they have. And if it takes military action to do so, then that's their only choice. Because Putin is not going to change. He can't change. It's in his genes. He's just a representative, as I said and I've repeated, of this long historical tradition. That's one thing. The other side of your question, and that is, what can the Ukrainian government do to counteract these attacks on it and denigration directed toward the present government from effectively an outside, in this case, enemy power? Well, I mean, that's sort of like saying what any other dictator who had wanted to take over another country and spreads false rumors against that country and false rumors and false statements, what can you do other than try to explain to the rest of the world that these kinds of attacks and these kinds of assumptions are totally untrue? A Of course, the best way to do that is not by just countering with words, but rather with actions. First and foremost, the Maidan that began, or the protests on the Maidan, that began back in November and lasted well into January on the Maidan, more than one night, more than one day, were Jews in living in Ukraine supporting the action on Maidan, Crimean Tatars living in Ukraine supporting the actions on Maidan. The first death, by the way, of anyone on the Maidan happened to be a Ukrainian of Armenian background. This is not ethnic Ukrainians versus Russia. This is the state of Ukraine and all the citizens of that country, regardless of their national background, who feel that their country, regardless of whether they are Jewish, Polish, ethnic Ukrainian, Armenian, etc., is being threatened. First threatened from within by their own government, which they wanted to get rid of, and they did, and now threatened by the outside. So the actions speak much louder than words. You've already said quite correctly that the prime minister of this new government, which is allegedly anti-Semitic, is Jewish and openly Jewish. How anti-Semitic can it be? The governor of Donetsk, in eastern Ukraine, of the new government, is Jewish. The same thing for the governor of Odessa, representing the new government, is Jewish. So, obviously, all of this is just an effort on the part of Putin and the Russian government to undermine, in whatever way possible, from their perspective, its enemy, and that is the present Ukrainian government that doesn't want to be part of Russia. It's purely and simple.
Well, Paul Mugosi, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Mugosi, who is the chair of Ukrainian studies and professor of history and political science at the University of Toronto. He has published 30 books, including A History of Ukraine, The Land and Its Peoples, The Roots of Ukrainian Nationalism, and Ukraine, an Illustrated History. His research interests focus on nationalism, in particular among ethnic groups living in border areas. And he's the author of the forthcoming book, Crimea and the Crimean Tatars. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about Obama suffering in the midterm elections.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's a regular contributor to CNN.com and Politico and has written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, and his most recent books include Jimmy Carter, Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, and his latest, Governing America, The Revival of Political History. He has an article at CNN, Obama May Hate the Midterm Results. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
And the president, of course, is obviously nervous. He's facing a midterm election coming up where most presidents fare poorly, particularly in their second term. He has even signaled that he's worried about this by recently calling the Democrats lazy. What can he do?
Well, the president is someone who's very cognizant of history, and he has been studying second-term presidencies since the minute he won re-election in 2012, and he realizes that these midterms don't go well for Democrats. There's really few exceptions. The only one recently has been Bill Clinton in 1998. Other than that, the party of the president loses seats or loses control of Congress. So, you know, he's trying to fight the trend as much as possible. His biggest objective is to try to rally Democrats, to try to rally loyal Democrats to come up and to counteract the very motivated conservative core of voters who's determined to regain control of the Senate and regain control of Congress in the process.
But that's the core of voters that do show up in midterms. They did in 2010, and obviously they'll be spending more money than they spent in 2010 and probably be better organized, the Republicans, and maybe they've learned from their last defeat, particularly in Ohio, they'll have a better ground game. So how is the president then going to counteract this? Because it all comes down to turnout, and in presidential elections, there's a huge turnout. In midterms, the turnout drops precipitously. Is it therefore up to the president to inspire voters to come out?
Well, it's difficult. What the president has been able to do in presidential elections is to inspire voters who usually don't participate or who are lukewarm in their interest in politics to come out and to support him. That's been one of his greatest accomplishments, both in 2008 and 2012. And certainly in his first election, he was able to mobilize loyal Democrats by focusing on the person who had been in power, George W. Bush. It's much trickier. In midterm elections, not as many people vote, and the people who do come out tend to be the loyal voters, the most active part of the electorate. And unfortunately for President Obama, he doesn't have the best relationship with that part of the Democratic Party. While conservatives are very energized to continue to cause problems for the president. So I think he's facing a very difficult electoral environment.
So, Julian Zelizer, what did Bill Clinton do then to reverse this trend?
Well, part of it wasn't really Bill Clinton. Part of it was a Republican Party that so badly overplayed its hand. This was in the middle of the impeachment. And not only were the Republicans moving forward with an impeachment of the president for the relationship with Monica Lewinsky and lying about it, but also they blitzed the airwaves with ads about this kind of issue. And it caused a backlash in the electorate that thought Republicans were really going way too far on this issue, and they were far off the center. And even many Republicans were unhappy with this. So I think in that case, you had a Republican Party that was actively sabotaging itself in a way where I'm not sure that's the case. Even though Republicans are unpopular right now, it's not quite 1998. And one final thing is then you had Newt Gingrich as a symbolic head of the party, and it made it easy for Democrats to warn about what was going to happen with continued Republican control, whereas today I think Speaker Boehner's not quite the same kind of figure.
Well, of course, there was a certain amount of optimism back after the shutdown of the government and the threatening of the to tank the economy on the part of the Tea Party caucus of the Republicans in the House. And, of course, there was a lot of discussion now that we're going to do really well in the midterms, so we're going to run on that issue. And then the botched launch of Obamacare's website seemed to swing the pendulum back. Do we have any figures on that? Do we really know where it stands, or are people's memories simply that short?
Well, the polls right now that have been coming out in the past few weeks don't favor the Democrats. Republicans are not popular. People don't trust them as much as the Democrats on specific issues. But the Democratic polls, especially in contested states, are not great. And what the polls are showing is, that the movement is in favor of the Republicans, including regaining the Senate. So, you know, was it the botched rollout of health care that overwhelmed negative images of what the Republicans had done? Perhaps, but it can also just be this broader historical trend that we've seen where, you know, the party in power just suffers for all the problems and controversies that surround a president.
So in your article at CNN, Julian Zelizer, again, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and a regular contributor to CNN and Politico, and the author of Governing America, The Revival of Political History. We're talking about his article at CNN, Obama May Hate the Midterm Results. When you give these historical examples, starting with Woodrow Wilson, and then, of course, the 1938 backlash against FDR, just 2 years following the 1936 landslide victory, and then the 58 Eisenhower, a popular president, losing the Senate and the House, and then in 86, another popular president, Ronald Reagan, losing the Senate and the House. So, again, the numbers are that there's not. My understanding is that just in terms of math and retirements, et cetera, the Republicans have an automatic advantage going into this November's elections, don't they, in the Senate?
Absolutely. You know, they're going in with a structural advantage, and you combine that with the political issues that you've discussed, including the controversy over the health care. And those two factors just make this more of an uphill battle for the Democrats than the Republicans at this point.
But what do you know about the health care issue? Because the Republicans have gone incredibly silent on that. You know, they were on a jihad from day one. They tried to stop it. They voted against it over 40 times to repeal it. They've all gone to the mat and incessantly. And now, all of a sudden, they've gone silent.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I think the polls on health care in particular are mixed. What we see is still there is a lot of discontent with the health care program broadly, and there are a lot of questions in the electorate about what's going to happen and how it will work, and some frustration with the delays that the administration has been putting forth. On the other hand, when people are polled on specific parts of the program, such as providing young people, you know, with health care until they're 26, or I'm sure if you polled the millions of people who now have health care through the Medicaid expansion, you get more positive results. I think, you know, what's happened is the issue has consumed so much political space that the administration and Democrats have had trouble pushing other parts of the record of this administration. And as you said, with the rollout, what it did do was help move the news away from the Republican tactics with the budget and the question of Republican obstruction, which was probably the most damaging thing the GOP faced. So even though the polls are mixed, I think Republicans are in a better position right now to take advantage of it than the Democrats are.
But it does seem from the historical records that you provided in your article at CNN, Julian Zelizer, Obama May Hate the Midterm Results. You know, Roosevelt got his thumping in 38 because he overreached with trying to stack the Supreme Court. And then, you know, there's other examples, but the most recent one was George Bush in 2006 in his second term, midterm, suffering a thumping, as he called it. And he overreached by trying to privatize Social Security. What has Obama done, do you think, on that level of historical precedent?
He hasn't overreached. I mean, I think it's different. You're right in that FDR's whole story was about having this huge reelection and going for bolder programs, especially with the packing of the Supreme Court. In other cases, it's been a question of a president trying to do too much, George W. Bush with privatizing Social Security. That's not been the story of President Obama. This is much more a story about a president struggling to implement his big idea. And it's been about an issue that isn't as sexy for most voters, administration, implementation, but it's turned into a huge political headache, and the opposition has been absolutely ruthless in moving forward with the issue. So I think we're in a very different situation than FDR faced on that in that regard.
So where is Obama's biggest problem? I mean, if he, as he recently indicated, that he's clearly signaling to the Democrats, I think he was signaling to mostly to the Congress and perhaps to the Senate, that they're too complacent. I think he used the word lazy, and they don't see this big express train running now coming down the tracks at them. And my understanding is that politicians are always thinking about their re-elections. Obviously, Obama's thinking, you know, I'm going to be a lame duck real soon if we lose the Senate. And so you'd think that out of self-preservation, the Democrats in the House and Senate would be more motivated. Is Obama right in suggesting that they're lazy and complacent?
I don't know, and I worry that in some respects, in looking and evaluating his leadership, it's a continued problem. He's had strained relations with Democrats from the start. He's often highly critical of what they do. Many congressional Democrats have criticized him and been frustrated with a president who they feel don't really respect the political risks they've taken and what they have worked on. And they wonder that this complaint doesn't necessarily reflect reality. I do think congressional Democrats very much would like to do better than they probably will. I think some Democrats are feeling pessimistic for all the big structural and historical reasons that have been discussed. Others think they're fighting very hard at this point, but they've been handed a very controversial policy. And they've been doing the best they can with that. And so they probably view this very different than the president, and those remarks in particular might only create more divisions within the Democratic Party rather than motivating Democrats to somehow run harder.
Well, Julian Salazar, early in the program we spoke with Senator Bernie Sanders, who is joining 28 Democrat senators along with one independent, Angus King of Maine. They're going to spend an all-nighter Monday night talking about raising awareness and warning about climate change. And arguably, that is the more liberal wing of the party. But they're taking a stand, and presumably this could end up being an issue along with income inequality. So how's the president then going to motivate the Democratic left, who feel alienated by him? They think he's too much of a centrist. One of his nominees is now being attacked in Georgia by the left. So what kind of, you know, strategy can Obama employ to, you know, inspire people who have lost faith in him?
Well, I think in some ways he might be most helpful as a foil. Meaning, you know, over time, he has consistently compromised on some big issues, such as climate change or even stronger financial regulation, always with the argument of this is what's possible in the current Congress and that he got the best he could. The cost of that was to continue alienating and angering key parts of the Democratic constituency who didn't agree with that assessment, felt he wasn't fighting the right fights or fighting hard enough. And the place this comes back to haunt you is in midterm elections. It's in congressional relations. Can he do much? Probably not. If he comes out and promises, you know, strong climate change legislation, I think a lot of Democratic activists will probably roll their eyes because they've heard that before and they haven't seen anything. So I think in some ways the argument has to come from Democratic leaders that if you want stronger legislation, if you want a president and a Congress that's going to deal with these issues, the real answer is to change Congress, not to continue to hope for a different White House or a president who will act differently. And I think that's how they can use him. This is what he didn't accomplish, and that's why we have to do that, and those are the votes we're looking for.
Well, Senator Sanders is toying with the idea of running for president because he feels that there's nobody in the Democratic Party, and particularly in what's likely to be the race in 2016 on the Democratic side, that Hillary Clinton will be sufficiently vocal and passionate about reviving the American middle class and rescuing working Americans and dealing with income inequality and climate change and the very issues that are being discussed all night, Monday night in the U.S. Senate. He's thinking maybe in terms of being up there in the debates like Dennis Kucinich was, that at least has the effect, even if you're not going to win and you don't have a snowball chance in hell, at least you do introduce to the American public in these forums, and clearly the Democrats will be running, you know, there'll be a lot of candidates perhaps in 2016, that at least he's going to force them to enter this debate. And I'm just wondering whether
if an independent senator has to force the Democrats to be more like the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, we're in trouble.
Well, you know, a lot of Democrats will obviously not be happy about that. They'll remember 2000. They'll remember Ralph Nader, who makes similar kinds of arguments. And many feel that that cost them the election and led to a much worse path for the nation. So he'll have to contend with that, and that memory is very strong still for many Democrats. But that traditionally is the argument of the maverick, of the third-party candidate, or the kind of independent member of a party who mounts a challenge, that it's not just about winning. It's about the message. It's about getting ideas in circulation that otherwise are going to be ignored. It's about forcing a party to deal with issues that they believe are politically impossible or politically unpopular. And that's the balance. You know, is that message more important than the potential risk that could come from a close race? And if he enters, that's a debate we're going to hear within the party, and they'll have to make a tough, he'll have to make a tough decision, as will his supporters.
Well, he did bring that up. He said, you know, I don't want to be a spoiler, obviously referring to Nader and in the Gore, Florida situation. He said, I don't want to help elect a right-wing Republican. You know, I guess he's saying, maybe I can't run as a third party for that reason, but maybe there's a way I can get into the Democratic debate. That's how I read it.
Yeah, that's what he is concerned about. I think it's not simply critics who will say that about him, but he himself doesn't want to play that role. On the other hand, I think there is a part of him that knows this tradition of the independent who brings up issues that otherwise can disappear from a party's agenda. So that's a struggle, I think, in this day and age, especially after 2000.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Julian Zelizer.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's a regular contributor to CNN.com and Politico and has written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, and his most recent books include Jimmy Carter, Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, and the latest, Governing America, The Revival of Political History. He has an article at CNN, Obama May Hate the Midterm Results. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.